For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we'll find out about John Gingrich's book, The Appetite Factory, and how he lost his sight during the writing of that book. With our friends at Tech Talk, we'll have a discussion about the new wave of AI narrators. And to balance the books, we'll have a chat with one of our favourite narrators, David Graham. All that and more on today's Read On. First on today's show, David Hogg spoke to author John Gingrich about his book, The Appetite Factory. John has retinitis pigmentosa, and during the writing of the book, he started to quickly lose his sight, as David will discover in a moment. But first, let's enter the world of his book, The Appetite Factory. As the head of crisis management at a Madison Avenue PR firm, Leonard Lundell spends his days counselling executives whose reputations have been ruined by scandal. But Leonard has been managing a strange and debilitating crisis of his own that's held him captive his entire adult life. Leonard likes to eat soap, pencils, paint chips, anything with no nutritional value. For years, he's kept his compulsion hidden behind a professional veneer, but when he signs an important client, an antisocial file clerk unwittingly discovers Leonard's secret and blackmails him into accommodating her own bizarre culinary indulgences. Set against the backdrop of Madison Avenue's marketing machine, in the months leading up to the 2008 financial crisis, The Appetite Factory is narrated by Adam Barr.
You're a brand. If we don't push back against what they're saying, the public will resurrect this incident any time your name is mentioned for the rest of your life. It just feels phony. The man stood and staggered to the bathroom. The thing about drunks, they were already crisis experts in their own way. They'd been selling different versions of themselves to family and coworkers for years. And they were resistant to change because they believed their own fictions. Leonard noticed subtle incongruities in the room now, stray details that disrupted the four-star narrative. A dime-sized chip of particle board was missing from a corner of the dresser. A framed print to the left of the television hung conspicuously lower than a print to the right. The wall clock's minute hand didn't line up with the dial markings.
I won't deny there's a performance element, Leonard said as the man knelt on the tile and hugged the toilet. We're a sentimental species. The only thing we like more than watching public figures self-immolate is a redemption narrative. That's why most people in my position advise the traditional route. Own up to what you did so you can stir their sympathies. So we send out these canned, corny statements acknowledging your newfound self-awareness in the hopes you'll get off the media's radar as quickly as possible. It's short-sighted. It fails to recognize the opportunity events like this present. The man stifled a laugh as he returned to the bed. What opportunity? You keep a low profile. You never talk to the press. I'm a computer programmer, not a celebrity. You basically created social media. You should put yourself out there. Own your authority. Facts and rumors are treated the same online. But we can use that to our advantage.
The Appetite Factory by John Gingrich, as read by Adam Barr. The author spoke to David Hogg.
You wrote The Appetite Factory while losing your sight. Can you go into your sight loss a little bit, please?
Sure. So I have retinitis pigmentosa, which is hereditary, progressive, incurable disease of the eye. To make a very complicated thing sort of brief, photoreceptor cells in the retinas lose their ability to process light, beginning from the outer ring of the retina and then going toward the center. And so you begin to experience progressively more and more vision loss, starting with your peripheral vision disappearing and then gradually narrowing toward the center of the eye, where your central vision eventually goes to in many cases. I was diagnosed with that when I was in my 30s. Most people who have the condition, because it's hereditary, they have a relative who has it, and so they have some idea what's coming. But in my case, things were a little different because my parents carried a recessive gene. So neither one of them expressed any symptoms whatsoever. And we didn't even know that they carried the recessive gene until their genetic profiles collaborated to make me. And then I began expressing that gene in adulthood. RP is a really kind of tricky eye disease because you never know what's going to come. You don't know how the disease is going to progress or when or how much eyesight you'll lose. Some people go completely blind by the time they're teenagers. In my case, I didn't start to lose my vision until I was in my 30s. And even for a while after I'd gotten diagnosed, things were relatively okay. And then it seemed one day I woke up and things went to hell very quickly. So it was just, that's just the way it manifested for me. I was writing the novel when I discovered I was losing my eyesight. Obviously, this really freaked me out and it lit a fire under me to finish the book as quickly as I could, which is saying something because I've just naturally always been a very slow writer. I finally, you know, finished the book and I managed to sell it. But by the time I managed to sell the book, I'd lost almost all of my eyesight. So I only have a couple degrees of vision left. And I made the idiotic decision not to tell my publisher that I'd lost my vision. I really hadn't told anybody. I'd kept it a secret. I finally got to a point where I just had to come clean and let everybody know. My friends, coworkers, the publishing company, you name it. I just had to let everybody know that this was happening to me. And so what I did was I wrote this article that was published in The Guardian, where I effectively came out of this disability closet and told everyone, surprise, I'm blind, which, as you can imagine, shocked people a great deal and confused people a great deal.
You mentioned there that you decided to keep it a secret. Why was that? Did you not want to be labeled as the blind author, or why did you decide to keep it a secret for so long?
I'll just say that, you know, I was embarrassed. And I think that is a discreetly reasonable position to take when you find out that you're disabled. What a lot of people who aren't disabled don't know is that along with the disability, there's this accompanying wave of anxiety and depression and loneliness and all these things that follow with it. And those are akin to a second disability in some ways. And so, you know, I was just embarrassed and I was upset. I also think that for a lot of people, men in particular, expressing a problem or coming clean with a problem operates off some baseline of vulnerability. And there's one thing that men collectively don't like to do, it's to admit that they're vulnerable. I count myself among that number, whether I consciously walk around with those beliefs or not. So I was embarrassed. I suppose when it came to the publishing company, I was worried how they were going to handle it. I mean, would you be enthusiastic about promoting and marketing a book written by a guy who can't see? I mean, that doesn't really sound like a pretty great proposition. It was something that I did, I think, pathologically out of a need to ensure my survival, at least in a professional sense. You know, this honestly did me a lot more harm than good. Pretending to see when you can't really, it's not the most idiotic thing you could do. And it just, you know, life became just a series of just daily embarrassments for me as a result of this. And it got to the point where things were so bad where I realized that I sort of dug a hole and it would just be much better to finally come out and come clean and to let people know. So the article was the way that I went about doing it. I just kind of laid it all out instead of calling every friend individually, contacting every coworker individually, reaching out to my publishers with some kind of like, you know, maudlin email about what had happened. I figured that the article was the best way to do it. I don't know. Life is messy. Things like disability are messy. And we never really process things in a very clean way, I guess. But that's okay. And, you know, I mean, that's just kind of like what the fog of consciousness is about that we're writing about when we tell stories.
So finally, John, what's next for you? And where can our listeners catch up with you online?
Sure. So I have a collection of short stories that I've already finished writing. And right now, I'm working on where and when that's going to show up and in what form. I've been publishing short stories for about 14 years, so I've decided to compile the best of those as well as some new ones, and that's going to be coming out within the next year or so. I'm also writing a number of essays on disability and blindness now that I've kind of gotten over this hump, and I I've kind of come clean with all this stuff. So I have some new material coming out in various different publications that I can't really talk about right now. You can, you know, you could find my book on Amazon, The Appetite Factory. It's available pretty much anywhere. My website is johngingrich.com, just my name, where, you know, you can find that book and sundry other things that I've written. And that's pretty much it.
Well, fantastic stuff. John Gingrich, author of The Appetite Factory. Thank you so much for joining us here on R&IB Connect Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You're launching a new software company this summer. So yeah, last night comes at a bad time. I want your team to dovetail the launch announcement with the apology statement we discussed over the phone. I can't. We're in beta. It's months away. The blogs have been speculating on it for a year. Push it forward. In the meantime, I want you to change your clothes. Start wearing jeans. Don't shave. I see where this is going, the man said. The populist image, the founder of a cutting-edge software company, gets into bar fights. It's Steve McQueen with a laptop. Just the image your industry needs.
The Appetite Factory by John Gingrich is available commercially now. Now, next on the show, something controversial, and something I'm sure we'll hear more about. AI, or artificially intelligent narrators. Can a computer replace a narrator? And should they? I mean, as a listener and a former Talking Books engineer, I'm firmly in the camp of the human voice. But working with R&IB, I know just how many books never get an audio release, and this might be a good way to get more books in an accessible format. Before I chat to the Tech Talk team, let's have a listen to some of the voices. First, this is Madison.
Movement in the greenhouse drew his eye, and a woman emerged. At first, he wasn't sure. The woman was about the right age, but there was something different about her, about the way she carried herself. The bright aura that had always surrounded Allison was missing from this woman. And yet, there was something achingly familiar about her. The woman raised a hand, as though to wave at him. Or was that wishful thinking? She fussed with her hair, then shaded her eyes and looked directly at him. And then he knew. This was Allison.
Now the AI voice, Jackson.
I looked up to find a wall of trees had materialized ahead of us. I hadn't noticed, because I'd been staring at my feet. I couldn't believe the fields actually had an end. It was further away than I would have liked, but at least I now had something tangible to run toward. I told myself I could make it. And I did. Barely. As soon as I ran into the forest, I collapsed onto the ground. It was soft and dry, and the relief from the sun was amazing. I lay there listening to my own breathing and feeling my chest move up and down. Up and down. I closed my eyes and felt the cool stillness all around me.
Can definitely tell Jackson, I think, is an AI. But for non-fiction, they use Helena.
On nights with a new moon, we would walk to the end of the beach to find our favorite constellation, the Pleiades. I know Bill carried within him deep currents of spiritual yearning that he found easiest to express through the beauty he saw in all places, wild. I have always believed in God and angels, in reincarnation, and life after death. Raised in the Episcopal tradition, I searched for answers to my yearning to understand what might lie beyond this life on earth.
And also for nonfiction, they use the voice Mitchell.
I do know that there is an extraordinary sense here of caring and sharing, and that the sharing includes a willingness to join in exercising crucial responsibility. This is enough for me. As the years add up, I find increasing good sense in falling back, when cold reason doesn't take me all the way I want to go, on faith. I am reasonably confident, at least in my heart, that in this enthralling valley, where the human purpose remains cradled in nature's special kindness, the future will continue to be a good idea.
All four of those were AI narrators. Let's join our friends at Tech Talk on R&IB Connect Radio for more.
You're listening to R&IB Connect Radio. I'm Dave Williams. audiobooks are important to all of us, especially those of us who are blind or partially sighted. Perhaps one of the most popular ways of reading, even for sighted people, whether you're in the car, washing up, lying in bed, audiobooks are the background to many of our lives. However, there has been a recent development that we are hoping to get our heads around, and here to help with that, Callum Stoneman, co-host of Tech Talk, and Robert Kirkwood, who I think of as Mr. Audiobooks himself, all the way from Read On. Gents, welcome in. Good to have your company. We are, of course, talking about AI narration, artificial intelligence narrating our audiobooks. Callum, can you just help us understand what is AI narration and how does it work?
It's kind of like a TTS or a text-to-speech, so the sort of thing that we have on our screen readers. And by that, I mean it's a computer-generated voice. But in this case, what they have done is they've created a computer-generated voice based on a human's voice, which so that makes it sound very natural and very, or hopefully at least, very pleasant to listen to. And then it's using artificial intelligence to, I guess, bring in even more of that natural sound. So to bring in intonation and to bring in expression. So essentially, it's a very, very good, high-quality, computer-generated voice reading audiobooks is the best kind of summary I could give of it.
Right, but what is the difference between the voice that you might hear from your screen reader or your smart speaker compared with one of these AI narrators?
I guess the difference is probably the clarity of the voice and how high quality it is. I mean, I think we all know that even the so-called natural voices that we can get on our screen readers and the voices of, for example, you know, the Alexa service, they are pretty natural sounding, but the way they phrase certain words, the way they pronounce certain words, the idea with these voices is that they've tried to make them so natural sounding that you probably could put up with it for a full 12-hour book, if not more.
And why do you think it is, Callum, you're a tech guy, why do you think it is that we're starting to hear about this now?
I think it's because of the improvements in what we can do with these computer-generated voices. I mean, and there's a cost-saving element to it as well. You know, it's not cheap for human narrators to come in and read these audiobooks. You know, they've got to be paid for their time. They've got to have a script. They've got to do a lot of editing, a lot of post-production. Whereas I guess these kind of books are cheaper to produce because you're not relying on a human. And if they can do it in a way that's still easy to listen to and you can still get the context of the book, then it's a good cost saving, and it allows for more books to be produced as well. You know, it gives them an easier way to produce audiobooks because if they've not got all that overhead behind them.
Robert, as host of Read On here on RNIB Connect Radio, you're clearly very close to the audiobook industry. Who do you think are the winners and losers with this? I know you've got some misgivings.
I do. I'll actually tell you a little bit about my background first and how lucky I was with the timing of it. So I graduated and immediately went into an audiobook company in 2000 who had just gone digital. The finished product went out on cassette tape, but a year later I moved to RNIB Talking Books just as they were going digital as well. And the revolution they had then kind of feels like the revolution we're having now. I like narrators, but I didn't think the voices were going to be good until I listened to some of them. And I don't think we're there yet, but we're very, very close to a point where you can't differentiate between a book narrated by a human or a book narrated by an AI. So, yeah, the narrators could lose out here, but I do know some narrators, some famous ones as well, who have licensed their voice. So they're still getting paid for it, but a computer is doing the actual reading for them. They have basically sold their voice. I know James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader, has done that. He's licensed his voice. Yeah, I do have misgivings about it. Can text-to-speech really, really replace a human?
But it's more than that, though, Robert, isn't it? More than text-to-speech, because, of course, Johnny Briggs licensed his voice to, you know, what we now know as the Daniel voice that we get on many speaking devices. So the Nuance Daniel voice is the guy off the from The Weakest Link, if you remember the TV show. You know, the Callum was the strongest link in the last round, but will the team have noticed? It's the same guy, and he licensed his voice to be used as a text-to-speech synthesizer. But with AI narration, there's something else going on, isn't there?
Yes, I've listened to quite a bit in preparation for this and before, and I've listened to something that I didn't realise was narrated by AI for Read On. I think you can tell, I really do think you can tell after a few minutes, and once it's in your head that it's an AI, you notice it more, and it took me out of the book slightly.
Do you think that's going to be a problem going forward, or do you think that's just an adjustment and that's something that we'll get over?
No, that's what I'm saying. By we're not there yet, but we're very close. I think that's a kink that's going to be ironed out. I mean, there's always been problems when you're doing an audiobook on pronunciation. I've had books that were, you know, set in the Highlands of Scotland, so I've had to phone up various tourist information boards and say, I wonder if you can help me. I have a list of words here of locales near you. Can you tell me how to say them? I'm going to record this call. And I've just went through, I've spelled out the word. They've told me how to pronounce it. I've given that to the narrator. These are problems that human narrators have. I think AI narrators will always have that. But if there's a final check, or if I wouldn't know how to do it. I wouldn't know how to, you know, if somebody said Ashinlake instead of Auchinlake, or Glasgow instead of Glasgow. You know, I wouldn't know how they could change that.
I live in Worcester, so I know exactly what you're saying. But, you know, the interesting thing about this, though, is it's not clear cut, is it? Because a bad human narrator can really destroy the experience of an audiobook.
Oh, certainly, yeah. And we've had some bad casting choices in R&IB Talking Book Celebrity before. yes.
Very diplomatically put there, Robert.
And especially in commercial audiobooks, you know, if, like, let's say footballers aren't the best people to read their own biographies.
Do you think, though, I mean, you mentioned biographies there and autobiographies, and of course we think about literary fiction. Do you think there are certain types of content that maybe lend themselves quite well to AI narration?
Yes, and the other side of that, there's stuff that really doesn't. You know, like an autobiography read by the person who wrote it, that should be the person to read it. But a non-fiction textbook, especially a non-fiction textbook that would normally not be considered to have an audio version, because of the whole accessibility side of this as well, I think non-fiction lends itself to the artificial voice. Textbooks in particular are actually ideal for an AI voice. But yet, you know, I like narrators. You can't beat the human voice at the moment. But with my working for R&IB and Read On and accessibility hat on, most books aren't available in audio, especially small print runs or, as I say, textbooks that have got a very limited field of people who are going to buy them.
And do you think there are other applications for AI narration outside of audiobooks?
Absolutely, because I used to work in transcription, which was my first job when I moved from R&IB Talking Books to the Scottish studios up in Glasgow. And my first job in Scotland was reading the instructions for a medicine that you had to put up your guide dog's bum. So things like that. You know, transcription is everything that's printed except a book. So we would read Scottish power bills. We would read, as I say, medicine instructions. We would read letters. Again, books that had a very limited run, especially self-published books. If someone requested that and had the amount of, you know, pages on their allowance, we could read them a book. Things like that, it's ideal for, especially things like power bills or things like that. If someone who can't access print had a phone number that they could phone up and their bill would be read out to them by an AI. That's absolutely perfect way to use this technology.
Right. And do you think there are any circumstances where an artificially generated narrator replaces a human and might in some cases actually be the better choice?
Well, as I say, for non-fiction and particularly tech books, yeah, they would be absolutely perfect for it. But for complicated fiction book or an autobiography, it should be a human.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the Stephen Fry read of Harry Potter, you know, doing the accents and the, you know, sort of making sound effects with your mouth and things like that, you know. Only a human can really pull that off. It's a performance, surely.
Oh, definitely. It's acting. I recently spoke to Rebecca Lachance, who's only just started reading audiobooks, and she's a stage performer. She's used to being up on stage and using the whole area, and she's got to direct that performance down the microphone. But she says she's as animated in the booth as she would be on stage. You know, she's moving around silently, obviously. Facial expressions are changing. She's living the book as she's reading it to give that better vocal performance. I spoke to narrator and actor Martin Jarvis, and he will take, you know, instead of if the line says, "Oh, I didn't know you were here," he said nervously, he would just say, "Oh, I didn't know you were here," you know, and say it would act the extra parts which an AI voice couldn't do.
Or maybe not yet.
Probably not yet. I mean, yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, the Harry Potter books, because that's the first thing that I thought of when I heard this story, because that's my absolute favourite set of audiobooks. That reading of Harry Potter by Stephen Fry is just incredible. You know, the voices, the accents. I think that's better acted than the film in some places. And yeah, an AI, I kind of wonder if it ever could do that. The tech guy in me really wants to think that it could. But I think it's scary how good these voices are. And I think I will be proved wrong in saying this, but I'm sceptical of whether an AI can really get different voices, different accents, different styles. You know, for example, if a sentence is said, you could say a sentence like, you know, "I think this is fantastic," but are you saying it excitedly or sarcastically? You know, and that really changes the context of that simple, you know, sentence.
Do either of you have any sense of the production techniques involved? Because, you know, I was speaking with someone else recently about this, and I think at the moment it's not just as simple as throwing some text at an engine and seeing what comes out. You know, there's a little bit of markup goes on, and of course you've got to get a really high quality sample of a professional human narrator, well recorded. It's still not completely automated, right?
There was one I looked at earlier today whereby you sent them the PDF of your book, clicked on the voice you wanted, and you get your book within 10 minutes. I think that's at the lower end of the market, but I think it can be as simple as giving it the text and clicking and downloading the book, yeah.
But presumably that'll depend on how well formatted your text is, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, GIGO is the old acronym in computing circles, garbage in, garbage out, you know, and we're all advocating for, you know, structured content and things to be labelled properly. And, of course, if the source material isn't, you know, and it'd be very interesting to see what happens with technical content as well. You know, if you had to describe a graph or an image that's in a book, because narrators sometimes do that, don't they, that you can be listening to a book and they might say, "Well, then there's a picture here of, you know," and then they'll describe the picture.
Yeah, it can be, especially with footnotes as well, it can be, you know, decisions made on the fly. Do you put the footnote in where the mark is, or do you wait to the end of the sentence? Do you just add it to the text? Yeah, there are a lot of things a narrator will do that AI won't. And then again, there are a lot of things an AI won't do, like it won't have a rumbly stomach. It won't come in for a second day of a book and have a cold. it won't make a mistake and swear for 5 minutes, you know.
Those things are usually edited out, but yeah, I know yeah, what you so, mean. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the samples we've listened to, there just seems to me to be an absence of breathing as well. That was very noticeable, I thought.
Yeah, and I was glad of that as well, because I don't know about you, but the breathing in the Alex voice that you can get on the Apple products, I just find that creepy. I could not listen to a book being read by that. But no, the sample, I mean, the Jackson voice that we've got a sample of, I think I've never tried listening to a full book with these, which I guess is the real test, but listening to the sample of that voice, I probably could.
Right, chaps, well we'll wrap this up then. What's the best way to kind of keep across all of this if someone's interested in learning more about AI narration? Callum, what do you suggest would be the best way to keep an ear on what's going on?
So if you want to hear the samples that are available, or even hear the books that are available in this format, if you go into Apple Books, if you've got an iOS device or a Mac, you can go to the Apple Books app and do a search for AI narration. All the books that are narrated by these AI voices should come up. And I guess for general news on this, I mean, we'll try and keep across it at Tech Talk.
We certainly will, yeah. And Robert Kirkwood, when can we hear Read On? I imagine AI narrated books are going to rear their head over there at some stage.
Yes, and I think we'll use some of this in Read On to start a discussion. I've got a quote actually from blind author Gordon Anthony. He says, "I'm conflicted about Apple's use of AI voices to read audiobooks. Being blind, I want access to more books, but I also don't want human narrators to become redundant. I fear these desires are mutually incompatible," which are my thoughts exactly. I really like narrators. I don't want them to be out of work, and I don't think for many books they can be replaced, but we'll certainly keep a close ear on this on Read On.
Indeed, yeah, and we'll be listening with great interest. Spontaneity, isn't it? That's the thing that a human narrator perhaps brings to the table. They have a moment of inspiration, you know, the ability to do something really creative. And can a machine really do that? So we will listen with much interest, both to the samples and to Read On. When are you on, Robert, in case anyone doesn't know?
Read On is on Fridays at 1 p.m. It's repeated at the weekend, and we're always available as a podcast. The best place, I think, is Podlink. If you go to podlink.com/rotas, R-O-T-E-S, that's Read On, the audiobook show. But pod.link/rotas.
And Tech Talk, of course, is on RNIB Connect Radio. First heard every Tuesday lunchtime at 1 p.m. and rerun for you on a Thursday evening at 9 and again on Saturday afternoon at 5. The podcast drops on a Friday from all the good places where you receive your podcasts. Just search for RNIB Tech Talk. Robert Kirkwood, Callum Stoneman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Dave and Callum at Tech Talk. There's a brand new episode of Tech Talk every Tuesday at 1 p.m. and it's always available as a podcast. Now, let's have a palate cleanser after that and let's hear from a classic, proper human, talking book narrator.
In the small hours, Sir Alfred Milner, High Commissioner for South Africa and Lieutenant Governor of Cape Colony, was woken by a bright light in his eyes. He had a stateroom on the starboard side of the upper deck. It was 4 a.m., he noted in his diary, the small red diary, which was the only companion and confidant of his travels.
That's David Graham reading The Boer War by Thomas Pakenham, one of many books he's narrated for RNIB, although many listeners may be more familiar with him, sounding like this.
This is the stately home of Lady Penelope Creighton Ward. Parker speaking.
He's very well known for providing many voices for Gerry Anderson, including Parker and Brains in Thunderbirds, and was the co-inventor of the voice of the Daleks. And when he joined me in the Talking Book Studios, I asked him about his latest book.
It's called Lifting the Latch. It's a book narrated by a wonderful chap called Mont Abbott, who spent his whole life on the land in Oxfordshire. And he has total recall. It's about a dying world in a language that's dying out too. In fact, there's a glossary at the end of the book with words that you probably never have heard of. Hmm. But an absolutely wonderful character. Sang in the church choir, a wonderful voice, never made much money, had two terrible accidents in his life which badly affected him, two tragedies, I would say, but indestructible. I admired him so much at the end of the book. He's a hero of mine now.
Now, it sounds like quite a challenging book to do.
Challenging book because I had to work on the accent and the syntax. He had dictated the book to a lady who got it in all order. But he had wonderful memory, almost total recall. It wasn't an easy book to read, but it was well worth the effort that you just have to put into books. You prepare them. Mm. A lot of the work goes in preparation, it's not easy to read books, but it's very rewarding, I find.
How long have you been reading for RNIB now?
Oh, I mean, at least 25, maybe 30 years, I think. I started in the old studios in Great Portland Street when we recorded on tape, which was much, much more laborious than these days in state-of-the-art studios.
Are there any books in that 25 years that really stand out?
Well, I would say this one does for a start. Lifting the Latch. But I've read so many. There was a book on the history of the State of Israel by a famous English Jewish historian. Mm. They give me books which have Jewish references because I was born Jewish and, I know quite a lot about it. Mm. Well, I enjoy reading them. But I must have read, I don't know, getting on for hundreds, I don't know how many books I've read. It's difficult to recall particular ones. But I finished the Lifting the Latch and I'm reading this book about, it's a children's book really, very funny and imaginative about two young kids who come across a weird machine on their travels. So I've just started that as well. Which is, it's a doddle compared with the other book.
Now, some children will know your voice because you're Grandpa Pig in Peppa Pig.
Yes, that's right, and the wise old elf in Ben and Holly. And my voice career goes back a long way, starting with Gerry Anderson. Mm. And then I created the original Dalek voices too, with an actor called Peter Hawkins many, many years ago, I think in 1962, Doctor Who. And I also appeared in two of the stories in Vision as an actor.
Yeah, because you go right back to the very beginning almost of Doctor Who. The episode Daleks was in 1963, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then I did The Gunfighters, which I think was in black and white, with the first Doctor Who, where I played a cowardly barman, and it's become a very well-known one. Mm. And then I did another story with Tom Baker, which I played a Russian. It was City of Death, but it was a nice part. I had to age up, so from sort of middle age to old age. So they had to take me out and put me in front of a camera and then do a bit more so that it all came up in a flash, you see.
Yeah. Now, the voice of the Daleks is iconic. How did you actually come up with it?
Well, it was done in the old Lime Grove Studios in Shepherd's Bush. We just played around with it. I did it with a chap called Peter Hawkins, now sadly not alive anymore, an old friend of mine. And he was a marvellous voice man too. He did the Flower Pot Men and all sorts of stuff. We came at it from the approach that it needed to be stylized and menacing.
Hmm.
And then they fed the voice through a synthesizer. So it made it even more menacing and, you know. So it went like something like that. That fouls. You know, that was that sort of stuttery thing.
Hmm.
And it seemed to work because they've gone down in vocal history, haven't they?
Now, you're also very well known for playing both Brains Parker and Gordon Tracy in the Thunderbolts.
Yes.
How did that association with Jenny Anderson come about?
Well, that's a long time ago. It was in the 50s, if you can believe it. I was doing a television film down at Elstree and in a pretty ropey script, and by one of those lovely accidents of fate, Jerry Anderson happened to be directing. And in between takes, I was playing some villain on the run. He mentioned that he was about to go into animation and puppet voices, cartoon voices. And I pricked up my ears at this. Well, I said, you know, I'm not bad at doing accents and voices. And if you do anything, I'd like to be considered. And about, I don't know, it was about 6 months later, he took my number and he phoned me. And then I ended up by doing 5 series for him, beginning with Four Feather Falls, then Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, and the big one, Thunderbirds.
Mm.
So it had a big effect on my career. But of course, parallel to that, I was working in the theatre and in television. And then I was a member of Laurence Olivier's company at the National Theatre before the new building for 2 years, and that was a wonderful experience, and toured with them in Australia in the Front Page, and worked with Laurence Olivier in a play called Saturday, Sunday, Monday with Franco Zeffirelli, and I did other plays in the West End, Arturo Uy, which is a famous Brecht play, and then 2 plays with Leonard Rossiter, the great Leonard Rossiter, who played in Arturo Uy, and then in Make and Break, a Michael Frayn play. You know, so, you know, I've kept dotting about from radio to the theatre and television. You know, I've had my ups and downs, all actors do, but I've been lucky. You know, you've got to take your opportunities, and, you know, sometimes you meet the right people, and it has a terrific effect on your career.
You were Big Brother in the 1984 Apple advert. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was Ridley Scott. I mean, that came out of left field. I mean, I went to see him because I do voiceovers commercials, but I haven't done many visuals. And I went up, and he said he was casting Big Brother, and they picked me out to do it. And when I arrived at the studio, they gave me a page of script. Well, I said, why didn't you send it to me? I can't learn this. So they wrote it all up. And they dressed me in this sort of, they plastered my hair down, and I wore 2 pairs of glasses, and I ended up reading it off a crib, you know. You wouldn't notice it, but it became very famous. And they show it every year at the Super Bowl in America, which is a big American football game.
Mm.
And then I cop a few repeats over the years, which has been great. Good luck and cheerio.
There are many books narrated by David Graham in the Talking Books Library, including Lifting the Latch by Sheila Stewart. Available now. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community, from remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Talking books are wonderful. They enable people who can't read anymore to join in with the rest of the world and be a part of the world. I think they're excellent. I enjoy biography. I enjoy travel. I enjoy classics. I enjoy a good tale. With some of the readers, there is a problem that you can go to sleep in the middle. when you get to my age.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
And finally, on today's Read On, a return to David Hogg and John Gingrich for the books of his life.
It's time once again for another one of the books of your life, where I'm glad to be joined by the author of The Appetite Factory, John Gingrich. Is there a book from your childhood, that one book that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I remember when I was very young, I was about 4 or 5 years old, my mom bought me this book. I still have it, and I actually read it to my daughter to this day. It was this collection of poems that had been compiled, and the people who had compiled this book had drawn accompanying illustrations for children. But these were poems that were pretty well known. It had poems by Edgar Allan Poe, like Annabelle Lee. It had The Raven and stuff like that. It had Little Orphaned Annie by James Whitcomb Riley. I don't know if you've ever read that one. It had The Jabberwocky. It had all kinds of just incredible poems, stuff by, Blake. And I would just sit there and I would just hear these stories over and over and over again. And I actually learned, I think, how to read by practicing reading these poems. And that stuff just always stuck with me, particularly Poe. As a young adult, I had fallen out of reading somewhere after high school. I really fell back into reading and fell in love with reading when I discovered Flannery O'Connor as an adult. And she's probably my favorite writer to this day. I mean, her short story collections are among the best I've ever read. Probably the biggest influence I have as a writer. I'd have to say that she's probably my go-to, my number one.
Hazel Moat sat at a forward angle on the green plush train seat, looking one minute at the window as if he might want to jump out of it, and the next down the aisle at the other end of the car. The train was racing through treetops that fell away at intervals and showed the sun standing very red on the edge of the farthest woods. Nearer, the ploughed fields curved and faded, and the few hogs nosing in the furrows looked like large spotted stones. Mrs. Wally B. Hitchcock, who was facing Moats in the section, said that she thought the early evening like this was the prettiest time of day, and she asked him if he didn't think so, too. She was a fat woman with pink collars and cuffs and pear-shaped legs that slanted off the train seat and didn't reach the floor. He looked at her a second and, without answering, leaned forward and stared down the length of the car again. She turned to see what was back there, but all she saw was a child peering around one of the sections, and, farther up at the end of the car, the porter opening the closet where the sheets were kept. "I guess you're going home," she said, turning back to him again. He didn't look, to her, much over 20, but he had a stiff, black, broad-brimmed hat on his lap, a hat that an elderly country preacher would wear. His suit was a glaring blue, and the price tag was still stapled on the sleeve of it. He didn't answer her or move his eyes from whatever he was looking at. The sack at his feet was an army duffel bag, and she decided that he had been in the army and had been released, and that now he was going home. She wanted to get close enough to see what the suit had cost him, but she found herself squinting instead at his eyes, trying almost to look into them. They were the color of pecan shells and set in deep sockets. The outline of a skull under his skin was plain and insistent. She felt irked and wrenched her attention loose and squinted at the price tag. The suit had cost him $11.98. She felt that placed him, and looked at his face again as if she were fortified against it now.
That's Eileen Seaton reading from Flannery O'Connor's Wiseblood, one of a number of Flannery O'Connor books in the Talking Books library. You'll also find many poetry collections available from RNIB.
Is there a book that you go back to read on a rainy day, a bit of a comfort read, if you will?
Yeah, for me, I have to say it's always The Great Gatsby. I have read that book more than any other book I've ever read. When it comes to The Great Gatsby, it's one of those stories that you discover something else every time. You know, I've read The Great Gatsby and been struck by the dialogue. And then I went back and another time I read it and I was struck by how present the theme is, how that it just looms over the entire story like a cloud. I've gone back and I've just focused on the voice. That last page is just among the best writing I've ever read. I always find something new in that book every time. It's like the book grows with you. So that's why Gatsby has always been my go-to when it comes to a book I'm going to reread again and again and again.
In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. He didn't say any more, but we've always been unusually communicative in a reserved way, and I understood that he meant a great deal more than that. In consequence, I'm inclined to reserve all judgments, a habit that has opened up many curious natures to me, and also made me the victim of not a few veteran bores. The abnormal mind is quick to detect and attach itself to this quality when it appears in a normal person, and so it came about that in college I was unjustly accused of being a politician, because I was privy to the secret griefs of wild, unknown men. Most of the confidences were unsought. Frequently I have feigned sleep, preoccupation, or a hostile levity, when I realized by some unmistakable sign that an intimate revelation was quivering on the horizon. For the intimate revelations of young men, or at least the terms in which they express them, are usually plagiaristic and marred by obvious suppressions. Reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope. I am still a little afraid of missing something if I forget that, as my father snobbishly suggested, and I snobbishly repeat. A sense of the fundamental decencies is parceled out unequally at birth. And, after boasting this way of my tolerance, I come to the admission that it has a limit. Conduct may be founded on the hard rock or the wet marshes, but after a certain point I don't care what it's founded on. When I came back from the East last autumn, I felt that I wanted the world to be in uniform and at a sort of moral attention forever. I wanted no more riotous excursions with privileged glimpses into the human heart. Only Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this book, was exempt from my reaction. Gatsby, who represented everything for which I have an unaffected scorn. If personality is an unbroken series of successful gestures, then there was something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life, as if he were related to one of those intricate machines that register earthquakes 10,000 miles away. This responsiveness had nothing to do with that flabby impressionability which is dignified under the name of the creative temperament. It was an extraordinary gift for hope, a romantic readiness such as I have never found in any other person and which is not likely I shall ever find again. No. Gatsby turned out all right at the end. It is what preyed on Gatsby, what foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams, that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men.
Peter Brook reading from The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, available from RNIB Talking Books.
And finally, John, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
Well, I just finished reading The Passenger by Cormac McCarthy. So I've been waiting 16 years for that to come out. It did. And I'm very happy. I'm very pleased with it. I think it's fantastic. I think McCarthy has always got the goods.
He was pacing again. Then he stopped. What if we packed up and just skedaddled? It wouldn't make any difference. What if we stayed? What Another 8 years of you and your penny dreadful friends? 9, math girl. 9, then. Why not? No, thank you. He paced, slowly rubbing his small, scarred head. He looked like he'd been brought into the world with ice tongs. He stopped at the window again.
You'll miss us, he said. We've come a long way together.
Sure, she said. It's been just wonderful. Look, this is all beside the point. Nobody's going to miss anybody.
We didn't even have to come, you know.
I don't know what you had to do. I'm not conversant with your duties. I never was. And now I don't care.
Yeah. You always did think the worst.
And was seldom disappointed.
Not every ectromelic hallucination who shows up in your boudoir on your birthday is out to get you. We tried to spread a little sunshine in a troubled world. What's wrong with that?
It's not my birthday. And I think we know what it is you've been spreading. Anyway, you're not going to get in my good graces, so just forget it.
You don't have any good graces. You're fresh out.
All the better. The kid was looking around the room.
Jesus, he said. This place really sucks. Did you see what just crossed the floor? What, are we completely out of Zyklon B? You were never exactly Mama's little housekeeper, but I think you've outdone yourself here. Time was you wouldn't be caught dead in a dump like this. Are you seeing to your person?
That's none of your business.
One more in a long history of unkempt premises. Yeah, well, you don't know what's in the offing, do you? If you'll pardon the pun. Ever thought about taking the veil? Okay, just thought I'd ask.
Why don't we just make what amends we can and let the rest go? Don't make it worse than it is.
Yeah, sure.
You knew this was coming. You like to pretend that I have secrets from you.
The Passenger by Cormac McCarthy is narrated by Julia Whelan and MacLeod Andrews and is available commercially.
John Gingrich, thanks so much for joining us here on R&IB Connect Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's it for today's Read On. Thanks to everyone who took part. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, the show is available as a podcast. Over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for R&IB Read On. I'm available on Twitter at @talking_books, and remember, I'm back every day with our sister show Talking Books. The full schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.